This special taper talk edition of the Swim Brief is brought to you by Chris DeSantis Coaching. Do you want to get back in the pool but don't have time for a team? Do you want to train but don't want to do boring workouts for a general group? Just want to get back in shape? Go to chrisdcoach.com, that's C-H-R-I-S-D as in downtown coach.com, and write me via the contact form. Training packages come in all shapes and sizes. This week's edition of the Swim Brief is also sponsored by Pro Swim Workouts. 1,200 workouts in that database and counting. And right now, you can sign up for a premium membership for your whole coaching staff or yourself just by entering the coupon code CRDeSantis. You get 20% off. That's Pro Swim Workouts, proswimworkouts.com. This week, I am joined by the biggest friend of the Swim Brief at the moment, Nico Messer. Nico and I talk taper. That's right. We're talking taper in December, which is probably the least likely month to taper in, and that's why it's the best time to talk about it. We talk about ways in which the word taper itself has become a dirty word, make some book recommendations, and we share some taper time stories of our own. Enjoy. What is up, Nico?
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having us back.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for coming back. And just for everybody that's listening, this is just me and Nico again today. We're getting back to, we've had a bunch of really, really interesting conversations with some other people. If you look back in the feed, you can find Alexis Keto and Kathleen Klein-Prindle and Paul Yetter, but this week we thought I'd just do Nico and I, and we'd address, we sort of get back to where we started with this podcast, which is addressing some of the big sort of topics in swim coaching, the kind of stuff that coaches like to talk about often on the pool deck. But before we get to that, what have you been up to this summer, Nico?
Well, not different stuff, you know, not really swimming since I've not been coaching on a really day-to-day basis.
Yep.
After stopping with the Army team in April, there's been some personal things that I had to take care of that took a lot of my time, and it was kind of the right time for everything. Now I'm kind of trying to get, you know, after hiring episode, I'm trying to get back in the game. And we'll see what happens next.
Yeah, it's definitely sort of turning the corner on another hiring season. I was shocked 5 minutes before we got onto recording this to see that Todd DeSorbo, who, I mean, what did he get hired, like a week ago, like it 9 days ago or something, has already assembled a whole coaching staff at the University of Virginia. Incredible. All credit to him.
Yeah, I coached one of the athletes that went to Virginia.
Yeah.
Yannick Kayser, their breaststroker, and like last Sunday, like a little bird told me that they offered a job to someone, and sure enough, on Monday they announced him.
Yeah.
And right after that, I heard that he already had chosen his staff, and it's just kind of whether or not things are going to work out. So, but it looks like a really awesome staff for Virginia. And,
yeah,
should be exciting to see them compete in the ACC in that setup.
Yeah, yeah. I've been having a good summer here. I've been traveling a bit. I've been going up and down the East Coast of the United States, working with some people and working with some teams. I got to go out to the U.S. Open, which was really fun. Saw a lot of old friends there that I had not seen, you know, for years, because I was out of the country and those people don't come to Denmark for for swimming meets. So that was really nice.
Yep.
You know, I was talking about that on a previous podcast, how some portion of your social life as a swim coach just comes from when there's a swim meet in town and you know that some of your friends and colleagues are going to be hanging around. So
That yeah, really US. I was in Minnesota last year, and it's kind of fun meet US Open.
Yeah.
Though they had a lot more foreign athletes this year, which I guess is kind of fun for you guys in the US.
I think it's fun. I'm not sure everybody in the US thinks it's fun, but I have not to sound like I'm bragging, but I have a soft spot for US Open because it was, I believe, it must have been now 5 years ago. I think Facebook just reminded me, but it was 5 years ago I brought Nico Van Doon to the US Open in Indianapolis, and he set a Swiss long course 100 butterfly record.
That was right after he missed qualifying for the Olympics, and
right.
Then he actually did the time there, but
yeah,
it was too late.
But it was like
I
a month afterwards.
That. Oh, yeah. Man.
Yeah, yeah. So, US Open is it's not the most exciting meet, but it's a really great opportunity for a lot of people, and especially when some swimmers from abroad come to participate. So anyway, today, due to popular demand, we're going to talk a little bit of taper. And you and I, before I could even press record, we were already off and running on taper because it's kind of gotten to be a bad word, taper. I mean, what do you think, Nico?
Yeah, you know, the thing is, there's not a real term in any language that is spoken in Switzerland. I need a German, French. I don't know a bit Italian because I'm not good in Italian, but I know there's not a proper word for it in German and French. So when I came back here, everyone calls it taper, but there are like terms they use depending on it, whether you speak German or French, and they're kind of different. And they mean something completely different as well. But what it comes down to... It always comes down to we have to stop doing work. We have to rest. And rest may be a good word for it, but what I notice with my athletes, like they move like in an inactive state. They don't want to do anything anymore because they think anything they do, it's going to hurt them. So kind of 1 year after I came back, I decided for myself, you know, taper starts on day one of training. whatever the cycle is, it could be, you know, going to short course nationals or then from after short course nationals to long course nationals, but taper starts on day one. So it's kind of like we're not going to get better just because we decide to sleep in 1 week before the big meet. We're not going to, a lot of stuff. But then there's that thing where they do get more... hyped about the big meets the week or 2 weeks before it because something changes and that's part of the training, that's part of the cycle and everything. So I actually stopped calling it taper and called it championship week or weeks depending on how many kind of taper weeks I was planning on, and that kind of worked out well for me. And then kind of last year was different because with the Army team, we didn't really have a lot of regular training or regular season, so there really was no taper. It was almost like a taper from day one on, just keep going for the full time. And prior to that, the club team I was working with, you know, it was a really good setup, but one of the reasons I went there is because the head coach there looked at swimming in a complete different way than I did, and he wanted me to go there because he wanted someone to challenge him on things. But they would what I would consider not taper at all because they were all kind of 200 specialists or maybe 400 IM. So taper was different from what I was used to, or what I thought taper would look like. What they did, I would like call a drop tape, like just stop doing stuff like 3 days out of the meet. But looking back at it, when I prepared a little bit our notes for this episode, I'm like, well, you know, they do taper. It's just different because taper starts on day one and their day one looked different than my day one with my team prior to them. So
there's a lot of things in there. I mean, I can totally relate to the athlete's sort of the inclination to shut down. I have a distinct memory, and like I should have apologized to my dad for this, but you know, my dad has a birthday in March, and so that's a popular taper time in the U.S. Or in a lot of places. And I can remember being 14 years old. It was going to be his 50th birthday party, and we were having a party for him, and my parents asked me to set up some tables and furniture. And I remember, you know, complaining, being like, I'm on taper. I can't do any kind of physical exertion. And I was such a little brat about it. You know, you mentioned the language. One of the things I always love to entertain people with in the U.S. is, and I think this is true for German as well, Danish is a super literal language. You know, all the words for things are like very descriptive of what they are, as opposed to taper. Like, what the hell does that mean? I mean, but the Danish, so the Danish word for taper is nedtrapning, which literally translated just means downstepping.
Yep.
So, you know, they've got it all down over there. Like, they have invented a word that's just about, like, you know, slowly stepping down. So I guess to sum up my own personal thoughts on taper, as I always say, I don't believe in magic. And I say that in this context to say, I don't believe that there's a magical, you know, something you can do in 2 weeks that will have a huge influence over your results. I just don't. And I think a lot of swim coaches are there. I mean, I think that, you know, a taper can sort of become a little bit magical with athletes, but I feel like most coaches I talk to are sort of in the camp of as we discussed, that it's just a rest period and it's no more or less influential, maybe even less influential than the period that of training that you do up to that rest period. So in my own coaching, I have trended more and more away from, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later, but I've trended more and more away from sort of these, what I call progressive overload schemes, which is, you know, where you sort of try to build and build and build and sort of actually build up some breakdown among the athletes. Like, I like to keep my training in a zone where even well away from the championship meet, the swimmers are very close to their sort of peak level, their peak level of performance. And then, you know, they're able to take some rest and adjust what they're doing somewhat to sort of peak a little bit, but not such a drastic difference. And I can remember when I was a swimmer, it was a drastic difference. I mean, the difference between my performance in a 100-yard race from not tapered to tapered was like 4 seconds. And I think that's idiotic. Like, if I could have a time machine and go back in time, I'd be like, this is not a good idea. Because I think that's too much. That's too much of a drastic change during this time period. But, you know, it was also a time when I sort of believed in the magic. And it was a time when one of the things that happened to me late when I was swimming in college, and I ran into this as a coach too, is I felt like every day, every season up to age 18, taper was about 2 weeks. And then all of a sudden it was 4 weeks. And So the first question we have to answer here is, what, you know, when should you start resting for a meet? Like, what is a good length of time to adjust your training for a major competition? What do you think, Nico?
Well, I think there's so much that goes into it. But if you, and I'm gonna link this up somewhere, but if you're like someone who's a non-formal educated coach like myself, and you want to learn a little bit more specific things about taper, there's a really good book that I have read and that I go back and read, just one page at a time, stuff that I want to know or remind myself about, just so I get to actually really know the real scientific things. But if you go in this book, and that's what you hear a lot, you know, like, it's anywhere from 10 days. It's probably like the shortest, although if people use like what we would call a drop tape, you know, it may only be 3 or 4 days for someone that's maybe a little bit more distance oriented. But most of the people that I know or what I used to do is kind of like the shortest is kind of 10 days, and then it can go, I guess, open end, you know. I know I'm going to take a really good example of someone who a lot of people know, Gary Holt Jr., who I was lucky to actually train and swim with. Like, his taper would like start 9 weeks out of the main event, you know, and he felt like he was late in that process. So I guess there's like you said, it starts on day one. You need to be ready to be close to your end time early in the season if possible, but maybe anywhere 10 to 35 days out of the major competition, depending on what distance, what event you may have your athlete swim in.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of factors, right? And, you know, there's age, there's gender, there's what kind of events you're going to swim, as you've referenced. I think, you know, one of the things that, and your Gary Hall example is great. It's a great one to bring up, because one of the things that I think where coaches and swimmers get into trouble with tapers is that yes, tapers and rest periods, you know, in order to do them the best way possible, it is individual, right? If you were just maximizing for individual people, like, yeah. But just in the same way that, only some of the most elite athletes in our sport get a totally individualized training plan, you know, you can survive if you're, if you're 12 years old, your coach doesn't need to, design a rest period with the precision of a heart surgeon in order for you to be able to swim fast at the end of the season. And that's not to say that getting one designed with the precision of a heart surgeon wouldn't help a little bit. I mean, I feel like I'm almost arguing against my own business, because this is what I do, right? I make individualized training for people. So by all means, if you want that, here, I'm here for you. But, I think that I know I've gotten into trouble as a coach, being the coach of 18 swimmers and trying to individualize 18 rest periods up to a major competition. That is a recipe for screwing it up, and also for, you know, a lot of stress for the swimmers and coaches as they prepare for a competition.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been putting up some workouts on the website from my time with the team in Zurich, which was a team, you know, where tapering may be a little bit different than most people would look at it. And it's just posted like last week, was maybe all the workouts from the week before last year's Swiss Long Course Nationals, which was our Olympic trials. I'm just looking back at those workouts. You know, I noticed we probably started taper a lot earlier before we really told the athletes that, hey, it's kind of time to get ready to be ready to swim fast and it's taper time. They just didn't notice, but like our workouts like started to have a lot more options, like and obviously these options were for people or groups of people of the team in mind, and we assigned people to groups. But if on any given day someone's like, today I feel like I should go with this group, or I don't feel like doing any of this, but I rather go and shower, that was probably what was happening that day. But it was not like just walking on deck and like, hey guys, it's taper, let's do 600 easy and then just do whatever you want to do.
Yeah,
it was a little bit more in a box.
I think this is one of those situations, Nico, where the thing that a lot of people end up worrying about is probably like at least the third most important thing to whether you're going to swim well at the major competition. I would gather that most of most disappointing results from a major competition, the most important factor is going to be what your training was like up to the rest period. And I think the second most important factor will be, did you rest enough during the rest period? And then the third one, you know, which is seems to be the one that people stress out the most about is, you know, did you rest in precisely the right yep. way? And so I think that a lot of people miss on one and two, or at least people that are that feel off at a major competition. And of course, we're just talking about the physical side of it. We're going to get into a little bit of the psychological side. But before we get to that, what about let's say you're training high volume, you're training low volume, you're training this way, you're training just by staring at the pool. I don't know how actually you rest from just doing staring at the pool, but how much should the training load be reduced? What do we know about that?
Well, you know, again, I looked it up, what they say in that book. And
which book?
It's,
tell me which book you're referencing.
Yeah, it's called Tapering and Peaking for Optimal Performance. It's a performance scientist who wrote it. You know, it's not just swimming. It's all sports in general. So what's in there is really, if you're uneducated like myself, you get educated about some of that stuff. That there's some scientific stuff in there, you know, and some people say, you know, science is never going to lie. You're going to be wrong. So there's some evidence in there that they found out over studies and stuff like that, but it's not only swimming specific. They talk different sports, but in general, what they say in there, I looked it up, they say like 40-60%, which suggests most performance gains for athletes. And obviously, you know, it's studies, so they say. So they observed benefits when less was done, and also when more was done. So bigger and smaller reductions came to the same result. I guess at the end, it depends on the athlete. But if you work with a group, if you go anywhere from 40-60%, you're going to rest them enough and reduce your training load. And what I found interesting, you know, just reading this, and I didn't think about that. I just, without reading that book at that time, I came to the same conclusion that when I noticed the athletes got in that inactive state, we forgot that taper doesn't mean you stop training. So it's like you start to do less. Maybe you give them a break on a morning, or you cut out an afternoon workout, or instead of going 2 hours, you keep going an hour and a half or stuff like that. But the intensity should not go down, because you want to go to a place where the intensity is going to be the highest of your whole season or of your cycle. And what I feel like a lot of people are, they miss their taper, is they go in that inactive state. So they take all the intensity out. And when they get to the meet, they're not used to that anymore. They're rested. They're ready to go. It's just they're not ready for the intensity of that environment.
Yeah. You know, this is one of the... This reduction in load, I think, actually is one of the things that there is the most consensus out there. So you reference that book, but you know, also if you read The Science of Winning by Jan Albrecht, you're going to find somewhere like about a 50% reduction in training volume in the rest periods that he suggests in there. If you are somebody that reads the ultra short race pace training literature, Russell advocates a reduction. I think he advocates like that you do a week of around 2/3 volume and then a week at half volume. So again, we're talking, you know, 40 to 60% if we're within that range. So when all the people, like when all the experts across very different sort of training ideologies are in agreement, I think you can feel pretty confident that it's somewhere around half is where you want to do it. And, you know, I think you talk about the intensity stuff. I think that's something I really struggled with early on as a coach. I got in my head that actually you did need some reduction in intensity. I think because part of me is a contrarian, and there were a lot of people out there that actually, at that time, I was running into a lot of people that thought that taper was actually a time for increase in intensity. And I think those are both wrong. I think that maintaining the level of intensity but reducing volume is really where it is. And that's a mistake that I've had to correct since the beginning of my coaching career. I think I got, you know, sometimes you read like one thing and especially when you're young, this is my excuse. This is me making excuses for reducing intensity, but you think like, oh, that's the thing. And so I'll have this little secret. And I had read some master swimmer and he was talking about, neurological fatigue. And that is a real thing, but I think that, just taking all that intensity the way I was taking it away from swimmers is it's not the best, for sure. And there are other ways for you to measure and look at neurological fatigue and see whether you got everything in the way that you want it. So let's talk about some different tapering methods. What are some terms out there that people have for different kinds of ways of doing it?
Well, you know, again, I personally wouldn't use any of the three that we're going to mention here. Again, I looked them up in the book because I wanted this to be as close to actually scientific as it could be, so we don't tell our listeners anything that wouldn't be true. Yeah. And you may have different names for them. I mean, one that we already mentioned was drop taper, which probably would be like more, if you look in the literature, reference as step taper. There's like the exponential taper and the linear taper. And it's kind of like, we probably have different name in the swimming community for the three of them. But as I say, like I personally didn't go into that specific thinking about these terms when looking at my tapers, or even like when I was talking to my athletes, it was kind of training is going to change because our big meet is going to come up. And probably what I did was like a mix of all of this in some ways. You know, I had some step taper in it, there was some exponential taper in it, but somewhat all of them were kind of linear throughout the cycle, because my tapers may, in my head and on my paper, would maybe go for 5 or 6 weeks. So there's no way you can do a step taper for 6 weeks.
Yeah, I think the easiest way to I know this is we're doing an audio podcast here, not a visual, but if you just picture, like, you know, an X and a Y axis on graph paper, linear, you know, picture a straight line, exponential, like picture a curved line, either, you know, decreasing really fast and then leveling off, or, you know, as you say, slow decay and then sort of falling off a cliff. And step taper, just picture like suddenly like a square edge, almost 90 degree angle of something falling off. Those are all out there, and people are using them effectively, and they have their comparative advantages and disadvantages. You know, one of the things that we keep coming back to in this, and definitely one of the areas I want to take this, is I think that a place where athletes and coaches get into trouble when it comes to taper is just managing the stress and the mental load of preparing for a big competition. You know, I think in the same way that that your performance in a big competition, the single most important factor is your physical training throughout that preparation period. It's the same way with what your mental preparation is. And so a lot of people make the mistake of sort of like, oh shit, big meet's coming up, am I ready? You know, or they sort of like wake up on the meet of the day and go, oh yeah, now I'm stressed. And all of a sudden it's like a huge brick wall right in front of their face, and they can't figure out how they're ever going to climb over it. And the mental stuff can really sneak up to you on taper. Yep. I mean, what kind of experiences have you had with that?
Well, similar, you know, but things that I noticed, and for people to understand, I've been coaching in Switzerland the last couple of years. So the setup with school, and it's all club swimming, even for like collegiate athletes, because we don't have collegiate sports.
Yeah.
So the setup is a little bit different, and one thing I noticed, you know, a lot of what the tapering actually happens, and I'm talking like senior type of athletes, so like 14, 15, the lowest for the girls, 15, 16 for guys, and up there's kind of like no limit. We had guys that are 26.
Yep.
But a lot of what you do, because our days are much longer in the afternoon than they are in the U.S., you know, just the taper happens by itself by cutting out a few sessions every week, because you need to give them a day or two or three where they can sleep in, get some more rest, get some more sleep, because they're still going to have schoolwork. They're still going to be up late to study for a test or anything. And the way I was doing it, I actually noticed that a lot of athletes do like the morning session if they can go to bed early after school. And I liked it because a lot of the athletes, the majority of the athletes I had, even like at nationals, they need to step up in the morning to swim fast. And I think there is something to it. And it's my opinion, but part of why a lot of people miss their taper is they just stop going to practice in the morning. And I know morning practice is completely out of discussion that we can go in at one point. But I'm not talking at going in at 6 in the morning when during taper. We may have time to get in at 7 or 7:30, depending when they have to go to school or to college. It gives them a better rest if they can go home after school in the afternoon, get their homework done, go to bed early, because that's something we talk about, get those 8, 9, 10 hours sleep, and then wake up in the morning and be active. It gives them a better day at school, And they're used to function in the morning. So what I actually started to do, instead of just cutting morning workouts, I started cutting both, like morning and afternoon. And another thing that I noticed that changed, like I was used to, like, the longer tape went, the shorter workouts were. So it's like at the end, like you get in, you do a 600 easy, you feel good, you go home. You know, it's like a 20-minute thing. Nothing against that. I still have some of those sessions, but I actually noticed that what you said, like the psychological aspect of tapering, because you start to do less and rest more, you have a lot more time to actually talk to your athletes, even like during sets or between sets. So I have been trying to be a lot better communicator.
Yeah.
In that specific part of our preparation, because you can talk about people, hey, you look good, how you feel about this, what do you think we need to do, and get as much of that individualized training as you can in a group setting. And out of this, my athletes start to realize, well, tapering actually is not going to be quicker for us. We're still going to be here 2 hours. But we're going to get much better work done because we do have time to just hang around on deck and chat a little bit, or take 5 minutes to go shower first and then jump in and stuff like that. And the other thing is, like, with Dryland, I wouldn't, like, hammer them for 45 minutes on Dryland, but I would still do maybe 10 or 15 minutes because it's good warm-up, it gets the blood flowing, it's good for team, you know, team spirit. But at the same time, we may just lay on our back, feet up, and do some breathing exercise or do some visualizing or any kind of stuff, you know, stuff like that. Just kind of changes how they feel about the work we do. And we still work hard. It's just they don't feel like we're working hard because we're getting a lot of more rest between all of it.
Yeah, I think, you know, you bring up a few points, and, you know, this is my area of educational background. So I do feel empowered to be a little bit more definitive on a couple of these topics. I think that, you know, one of the things you referenced that I think is really, really important is when you're a coach and you get to a rest period, really being emotionally in tune with your athletes. Because they will give you some cues if tension is building for them, if you know anxiety is building for them, they're going to give you some cues beforehand. I think one of the temptations we feel, and this is not me trying to correct you, but you want to reassure athletes, right? Because they may be getting a little bit unsure of themselves, and you want to reassure them. You know, I think you want to be very careful. And really check in with your athletes on how what you're communicating, how it's coming out the other end. You know, one of the mistakes I made that I learned to do better actually was telling some athletes that they looked good in preparation, because what they heard was not, oh, I'm doing well. They heard, coach expects a really big performance from me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was like a huge tension builder. You know, I actually wrote a blog post also about, you know, visualization has become is one of the most widely used, I would say, mental preparation techniques out there. And it definitely has its uses. But I would caution people, there are situations where visualization can really go wrong for you. One thing I would say is, if you have some really competition, some athletes with a lot of competition anxiety, I would be very careful with visualization, because they're going to, if they go all the way, they're going to put themselves all the way in that stressful, that sort of thing that they get overwhelmed by. And it's only going to make them feel a little bit more nervous about what's coming. Now, there are so many things you can do sort of from the beginning of a season to help somebody who is suffering from sort of that level of anxiety. And a lot of it starts with that sort of emotional communication from the beginning of a season, because, you know, you can tend to think it's a rational problem, a nuts and bolts thing, like, oh, you have nothing to be nervous about. But it's a feeling, and it's a jumble of uncontrolled and sort of measured feelings, and working through those. Not all coaches are totally comfortable. I know it's taken some time for me. One of my most vivid memories of a nervous athlete was we were, you know, a day away from competition, and I don't think that I had been doing a good enough job managing how this athlete was doing emotionally, and she got out of the water and she just burst into tears. You know, she'd just done like a 25 sprint or something. Yep. Right? And she just got out and she burst into tears. And I had two of her male teammates who were like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah. You know,
what is happening? And, you know, I sort of got her off to the side to have a conversation. And, you know, I told those guys, I just said, hey, look, this is just, she really cares about how she's going to do tomorrow. And I know you can't understand that reaction for really caring about something, but that's what this means. And helping many anxious athletes, this rest period, where I wanted to come all around, the rest period can be really tough for them, because they soothe some of their, like, part of their coping for feeling anxious is getting to the pool and working their butt off. And then they can sort of go home and go, you know, I did everything I could today to get better.
Yeah.
Well, when they come to a swim practice and, you know, swim a meet warm up and go home, all of a sudden that coping mechanism has been taken away from them, and they have to deal with the most stressful part of their season. So that's just sort of like a word to the wise for coaches out there, that this is something that I've definitely run into frequently, and I know a lot of coaches run into frequently when it comes to taper.
No, and I would suggest, you know, I mean, you're the expert, you're educated on this. I'm not. But if you feel like this is something you need to improve, you can read a book on it, but I would suggest don't do it. Get help. You know? As a swim coach, you're not supposed to be an expert in this. Maybe you are, because you studied it in college, or you took some class or whatever, and maybe you understand it perfectly. But most probably you won't. And there are people that do. And they're more than willing to help. You just need to go and get the help. It won't lessen any of what you do, and you're probably going to learn something, how you can better interact with your athletes during that time. And in the beginning, you may need a lot of help, and then as you progress, you may need less and less. But it's going to make you feel secure, and that is going to be good for your athletes.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you 100%. I think, you know, if you have the opportunity first, if you don't feel comfortable, if you don't have the education, get somebody, because it's going to be hugely valuable to you and your athletes. And this is a topic where I feel personally very knowledgeable and comfortable. When it comes time to design a dry land program, I'm getting somebody, an expert from outside, to help me with that. Right. I'm calling in an expert, because I really don't know that much on the topic, and I learn from the people that I come in, but it's there are people out there, and you can really enhance what you're doing by contacting somebody from the outside. All right, any closing thoughts on rest, Nico?
Well, you know, I think we kind of came up to it, but if your taper is going to be effective, your body and your mind is going to be ready to go. It's not just like you slept 8 hours for 5 days before the meet. You did a good training 2 weeks prior to the big meet. It starts on day one, and if you're going to be ready, your body is going to be ready, but your mind is also going to be ready. What I noticed, the people that come in, that trust your plan, that do the work, it usually works out for the best. It never does 100%. It probably never will. You know, there's too much that can happen. Yeah. But if you have a plan, you stick to it, you believe in it, the athletes do the same, and they're there every day or whenever you have your workouts, and they did everything, it usually works out for those people. And the people that don't succeed are usually the people that didn't do it all in, you know?
Yeah. It's better. I mean, it's a better experiment to commit to something all in than to just sort of like dip your toe in to something. You'll find out much more whether it works for you when you really commit to something. You know? So go out, and I think with the link to this podcast, we're gonna also give out an Amazon link to the book that you're referencing. If people want to read that stuff for themselves, as I said to Olbrecht, is a good resource. I'm not sure how easy his book is to come by.
It's really hard on paperback. You almost have to buy it from him.
Yeah.
If you ever see him, but if you have a Kindle, you can get it on Kindle. That's really easy.
Yeah. And Russell, Brent Russell has some free resources out there, as well. So, there's plenty of reading to be done on this topic, if you want it. And, all right. Well, it was great talking to you, Nico. Great talking some taper, talking some swimming. Enjoy yourself out there in the mountains.
And, thank you.
I'll talk to you soon.
Soon, yeah. Bye, Chris.
Thanks so much to Nico for all that taper goodness. For more great swimming conversations, go to chrisdcoach.com. That's C-H-R-I-S-D, as in DeSantis, coach.com. Check out the new comments section. I'll keep it around just as long as you behave. You can also find me at Chris DeSantis Coaching on Facebook. Write me a message. Give me some feedback. You can also make an account at Pro Swim Workouts. That's proswimworkouts.com. And get access to their database, 1,200 workouts and growing. Remember to use the coupon code CRDeSantis when registering for a premium subscription and get 20% off. Thanks for listening. See you next week.